you ever feel like what you learned in law school didn't prepare you for the world of running a law practice? Law school didn't teach us how to start our practices the right way so that we could scale them into a thriving business. We didn't learn how to make sure that our businesses would meet our financial goals and provide the type of lifestyle we deserve. After 10 years, I was fed up with struggling in my practice and decided to begin a journey to scaling a successful practice that would actually allow me to finally live the life I've always dreamed of. I invite you to listen in on the conversations I'm having with some of the most successful solo and small firm practitioners, along with leading business entrepreneurs, and share how I am implementing what I am learning, all with the goal of helping you take control of your practice and your life. This is The Law Entrepreneur. Hey there, fellow law entrepreneurs. Welcome to episode 196 of The Law Entrepreneur. I'm Neil Tyra, your host once again. Today, my guest is Carol Williams. Carol is an immigration attorney working out of Southern Florida at the moment. And you're going to hear about her journey, how she went from being in big law, coming out of law school, and then deciding to open a practice on her own, and then moving towards a virtual practice. And then you're also going to get to see how ignorant I am when it comes to understanding the nuances of, or the general parameters, really, more rather than nuances, of immigration law. And, you know, the fact that I didn't truly recognize that it was a national practice based on federal law and not a state practice. Kind of goes to show how stupid I am. But anyway, it's a fun interview. We talk about a lot about tech solutions as well. So I hope you enjoy listening to my friend, Carol Williams. Carol Williams, welcome to The Law Entrepreneur.
Hi, how are you?
I'm awesome. How about yourself?
I am good. Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here with you today.
I am ecstatic that you could be here with us today, Carol. Tell our audience a little bit about yourself and how you came to be where you are today.
Sure. So I am Carol Williams. I am the owner of Williams Immigration, which is a boutique law firm. I'm based out of sunny South Florida, but I handle cases all over the country and all over the globe. And I spent a fair amount of my career in big law, learning from some of the best and absolutely loving immigration there. And then I spent some time working within the Immigration Service in DC at their headquarters. So I was part of the government machine for a little while, which was also incredibly interesting to see immigration from the inside perspective, inside the government perspective. And then shortly after that, launched out on my own. So now I've had my own firm for about a little over 6 years now.
Well, you already answered or broached on a subject that I wanted to ask you about. We don't delve too much on this program about the intricacies of the various practice areas, but I have to tell you that I really don't know a whole heck of a lot about immigration law. I mean, I know conceptually what it does, you know, but you know, and one of the things that strikes me, and you mentioned, is that you, while you're headquartered in Florida, because it's based on federal law, I guess you can take clients from all over the country, and in fact, they don't even have to be physically located in the country, do they?
No, that's you're exactly right. It's all federal. So the way that I explain it to people is, no one state ever determines who is allowed to cross the border into the U.S. So Colorado doesn't decide, New York doesn't decide, Iowa doesn't decide, Florida doesn't decide. Only the federal government decides who can cross any of our borders and come in. So it is truly a federal practice. So the rule is, you just need to be barred in one state or DC, and you can practice anywhere in the country.
You know, in the past, just the practicality of how one practiced law would probably, even with those caveats, restrict you to being able to service clients only really in your immediate area, or maybe long distance by telephone back in the old days. But now, in the age of the internet and online presence and the fact that you can reach anywhere around the world almost instantaneously, your potential market base really is worldwide and very large.
It really is. And that is part of the fun of it. I love my clients because they are from quite literally all over the world. And when you work so closely with clients on their immigration issues, you collect a lot of data on, I collect a lot of data on my clients, but there's always a story behind the data. And so a lot of times I get the story behind the data. So if there was a divorce in the picture, if there was a crime somewhere in the past, all of that data, you know, if you've had 8 jobs, but only 3 of them were actually relevant to the current position that, you know, that I'm trying to get you work authorization for, I get the story about the 3 jobs that were relevant. And those 3 jobs could have been in 3 completely different countries. And of course, we start talking about travel and food and culture. And I love it. I love it every day.
Yeah. And you know, just because I'm a curmudgeon and this is the way my mind works, man, I bet the thank you gifts are pretty impressive from your clients.
I have gotten some very nice thank you gifts.
Yeah, I would just say, because it's a really, really important personal deal for people. And if you help them with that, you know, not that you're in the business for that reason, but I can just imagine that if you're helping a client from some far-flung country around on the other side of the globe, if they want to show their appreciation to their wonderful attorney, there's a whole host of opportunities that maybe wouldn't be available to, you know, to a domestic client, for example.
Sure. But, you know, I will say the tangible gifts are lovely. They really are. I think the gifts that I love the most are the photographs of children. And generally the caption says something to the effect of, because of you, we all now get to live together.
Yeah. And it's almost like that commercial. It's, you know, the mask from the plains of Africa is great, but reuniting a family, that's priceless.
It really, really is. You know, I had one client tell me that they had the best Valentine's Day that they've ever had as a couple after one person was able to get their green card.
So the other thing that strikes me, it's a lovely story, I don't mean to minimize that, but one of the things I observe about immigration law as a practicing attorney here in Maryland is that my exposure to it really only comes in primarily 2 areas. One, the challenge that we face, you know, with securing our borders and addressing the issues of permitted immigration across the borders. And the second is the integration with other aspects of the law, say with family law or with criminal law. One, you have to be concerned in some cases about the effects that decisions in one area of law might have on the immigration status of the client. I suppose that there are other areas where immigration touches the lives of the clients?
Sure. I mean, it definitely plays into and intersects with family law. It plays in with criminal law all the time. But it also touches employment law all the time. A lot of my clients are looking, they are businesses, they are HR professionals, they're in-house counsel, and they're looking to hire someone who happens to be a foreign national. So they need to figure out how do we get this person on board with the right work authorized visa? And then once we get them on board, the question then is, how do we keep them indefinitely? We really like this person and this person really likes us. How do we keep them here? And do we need to do anything special or different for the person that is not a U.S. citizen than we need to do for the U.S. citizen who's sitting right next to them doing the same job?
I have to admit that in preparation for this recording, you know, reviewing your website and particularly your writings on the blog on your website, which were really very strong, very informative. I guess I'd never had stopped to think that aside from the individual seeking immigration services or help in applying for a particular type of status, I never stopped to think that your clients actually could be the, as you said, the businesses that are seeking to hire them.
Sure, sure. There's a huge lobby right now. We've had a lot of changes with our current White House administration when it comes to immigration.
Sure. that's an understatement.
Yes. But a lot of what hits the news is not about the changes that we're seeing that are impacting the businesses.
Yeah.
The businesses that are looking to hire foreign nationals. A lot of those changes we don't see on the 5-second sound bites every single night on the 6 o'clock, 5 o'clock, and 11 o'clock, and 11:30 news cycle, yeah. Right? So they are an everyday part of my world, but it doesn't surprise me that that's not an everyday part of your world.
Yeah, it's not.
But there are businesses all over the country that when they get a resume and the best person that they've got in their stack of resumes happens to be someone that's not a US citizen, they have to go through and have a conversation and work with someone like me to get that person the right work authorization.
Yeah. I had never stopped to consider that. And particularly that's interesting or kind of ironic for me. Here where I live, Montgomery County, Maryland, which I know you were from the D.C. area for a little while, you know, is a high-tech corridor. We have lots of high-tech businesses and particularly pharmaceutical companies who employ a lot of foreign nationals and foreign employees. So I can see now where they would absolutely need the services of somebody like your firm.
Yeah, yeah. The other thing that I always find so interesting is that I think everybody does this based on what they do for a living. So I happen to be an immigration lawyer. So whenever I'm watching television and I see a feel-good story, and this always happens when I see there's a story about a young child who comes into the U.S. with their parents and they need some sort of medical care that they can't get at home. My first thought is never, oh, that's so sad. It's always like, I wonder who did their visa work.
Yeah, exactly.
It literally permeates everything that I do.
Well, you know, again, not to make it too personal and to expose my own ignorance, which I'm happily and readily able to do. But I mean, I was thinking about this last night as I watched the University of Maryland basketball team. They have a young player from South Sudan, and mm-hmm. they talked about how difficult it was to bring him to this country when he was in high school to play basketball.
Right.
And how they had to go through a lot of, you know, jump through a lot of hoops. No pun intended there. Yeah. But in order for him to play hoops.
Yeah. 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 It's the immigration system is a very complex maze of laws.
Well, that's you know, about as much as I know about immigration law, and obviously I didn't know a lot about it, so I appreciate all that insight. Did you know from the beginning that that's what you wanted to do, that immigration law was something you wanted to practice, or did you fall into that and learn to love it?
I fell into it. I knew I wanted to be a lawyer since I was 7 years old. I knew I wanted to be a criminal lawyer. And then I went to law school and I hated criminal law.
Yeah, that's always the problem.
Right. And I said, no, I'm going to continue to give this criminal law situation a chance. And then I took evidence and then I was like, okay, I absolutely hate this. So I decided to go overseas one summer, second summer of law school. I went abroad. I took one class. That class happened to be immigration and I fell in love with it. And I have been practicing and doing all things immigration ever since.
So you made, at least in your mind, the conceptual change that you wanted to be an immigration lawyer while in law school. So you came out then looking for immigration law positions.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because I will say, when you go abroad the summer of your second year and you don't get that all important job, it's all but guaranteed that you graduate unemployed, which I did.
Yeah. Well, you know, the other way to guarantee graduating unemployed is to get the grades that I got. So
there you go.
There you go. Birds of a feather. Now, you said you knew you wanted to be an attorney at a very young age. What prompted that?
In my family, we had dinner together every night. So that would have been my mom, my dad, my brother, and myself. And my dad loves history and loves the news and current events. So every night during dinner, the TV was on and it was always on to the news. And I just remember thinking, even at such a very young age, that the people's faces, and usually they were mugshots, that they were passing us off on the screen. I always wondered, not if they were guilty or innocent, but if they understood the process. Mm. And even being so young, I obviously didn't understand the process, but I just always wondered if they understood the process and if they had someone in their corner to explain the process to them and to help them through whatever that process was. And so I decided that I wanted to be that person.
Interesting. Of course, we now call that access to justice in many ways. But then how is it that you came to decide that you wanted to go out and practice on a solo basis?
So I had been in big firms, which was an amazing experience. And then I had been in the government, which was amazing, but in a completely different way. And then I just decided that I wanted more control of my career. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to take different cases, different case types that didn't really make sense to take in a big law firm. Some of my more individualized work, some of the more complex cases I do, are really not well suited on a large scale in a large law firm. They're just not. And so I really decided that I wanted to take on these cases and I wanted to have complete autonomy and complete freedom to take on cases that I wanted and to really go after some of the more complex cases that some other folks don't want to handle, or, you know, talk with clients who have been denied twice and can't quite figure out what's happening.
So when you made that decision that you're going to open your own practice, how carefully did you consider the process? And did you have a long, you know, on-ramp to your office? Or did you, like me, just leap off the cliff and figure out on the way down?
Oh, I completely jumped off the cliff and just knew I could fly.
Yeah. Which frankly, you know, I asked that question just about all of our solo practitioners or small firm practitioners. And I would say the overwhelming majority of them said, of course not. I just decided and then figured it out along the way. I wish I'd planned more.
Yeah. And I think that is the entrepreneurial spirit in every single law firm owner. You just leap off the cliff.
So when you went off that cliff, what did your practice look like? Did you decide you needed office space, or were you going to work from the kitchen table for a while, or how did you physically set your office up?
I decided that I was in Atlanta when I started my office. So I decided that I needed to be in the center where all the businesses and the banks were. So I set myself up in an area of town called Buckhead, which is right down the street from a more traditional downtown area.
I know Buckhead only too well.
Okay. So I set myself up in Buckhead because I told myself that's where businesses are. Sure. And that's where I need to be. And it was accessible via public transportation. And I told myself that my clients would definitely need that. And so
that's a fair point too. You're coming at it from the client perspective, not necessarily that you needed to use transportation. That's interesting.
I did not actually need to be in Buckhead. Me personally, I didn't need to be there, but I figured that's where my clients would be. So I should put myself next to my clients and make it easy for them. And so I started off with a virtual office space, and I was in there only when I needed conference room space, and they answered my phones and got my mail and all that good stuff. And that was perfect. And then I realized that my clients really hated coming into Buckhead because the traffic was so congested. They definitely didn't want to see me in the morning. They definitely didn't want to see me late afternoon because then they were going to be caught in traffic. They definitely didn't want to see me in the middle of the day because that meant that they had to take time off work.
Yeah.
And fight, you know, and just get in and then get out of Buckhead as soon as possible. And so I really started to listen when I kept hearing the same thing over and over and over and over again from all of my clients. And I came to the realization that, in fact, I probably don't actually need physical office space. So over time, it's morphed. And now I don't have physical office space. I am pretty much 100% virtual. Very few of my clients ever want to meet me in person until we get to the interview phase of our engagement together. And honestly, there are some clients that I have that sit in downtown Atlanta and I have never met them in person.
It's so interesting to hear that because I had something of the same journey. And I was trying to market my estate planning practice to younger couples and younger clients just starting on their earning career and wanting to get their ducks in a row early. And I sensed a hesitancy of their coming into the office. And finally, I asked. I said, "You know, what's the issue? What's the problem?" They said, "Yeah, you know, I got to take time off from work to come see you, or you know, we can't come together. We got to come one at a time because somebody's got to watch the kid, or we got to hire a babysitter. Well, how about if I come to your place? No, well, then we gotta clean the house, and we don't want to have to do that. And then, well, how about if we do it online? Yes.
Yes.
So, you know, that is the way of the future for so many practice areas. I don't believe that that's true for all practice areas. Some cases, I think you're going to, you know, criminal law, I think you're going to have to be, you know, you don't want to invite people in your home. I think you have to be where the clients need you. But, right. But by and large, I think a lot of attorneys are going to have that same experience.
And, you know, it was very eye-opening to me because I just really started hearing it over and over and over again. I mean, it got to the point where after about 2 solid months of doing in-person consultations, every single person that retained my firm said to me, "Do I have to come back and meet you in the office?"
Yeah.
And I said, "Well, no, you don't actually." And the look of relief on their faces because they didn't have to coordinate all these different schedules. They didn't have to ask for time off. You know, it's so easy for them now. If we want to set a call, we set a call. It's usually during lunchtime and they will go sit out in their car. We'll hop on a call or we'll hop on a video call. They'll get their questions answered. They'll finish up their lunch. They'll go back to work and they don't, you know, and they don't have to take time off and they still get their questions answered.
Yeah. And, you know, that decision on your part, I think, illustrates that you're really kind of a client-oriented practice and a client-oriented attorney. And it does change the very nature of how you practice law, not just mechanically, but kind of your viewpoint and your approach to the practice and the approach to the service that you offer your clients, don't you think?
You know, it does because it's not about what I want and it's not about what I need. I can have someone leave me a message and they'll, you know, give me sort of a real brief overview of what's going on in their life. And from that 2-minute message, in my mind, I can come up with an entire case strategy, right? Because, you know, I've been doing this for over 20 years. Yeah. I can come up with an entire case strategy. But when I talk with that person and, you know, and really start to dig in and ask them, well, what's important to you? What are you looking to do? Why did you call me? Why now? If my case strategy involves A through Z, but they're only focused on D, it doesn't matter. All the other letters in the alphabet, my whole strategy, it doesn't matter. They want to focus on D because that's what brought them into the office.
Yeah.
So I had to really kind of learn over the years that I need to focus on D with them. And if possible, get them to understand why all the other pieces of the strategy are to their benefit.
Sure.
But if they don't see why that's to their benefit, I help them focus on D, you know, to the extent that I can just you know, sort of take D out and just right. focus on that, then, you know, then that's what I do. And I find that that makes for a very happy client.
Well, you know, somebody explained it to me at one point that, you know, the days when, and I was guilty of this, you know, when I was doing family law, you know, I had a physical office space. I only met clients in the physical office space. I only met them during, you know, regular normal business hours because I, you know, wanted this proper work-life balance and I wanted to set some boundaries and I only responded to the emails at a specific time because, you know, productivity issues and all of this. And somebody explained it to me at one point, well, this whole practice that you've built is really all about you and isn't really about your clients. And if you practice law in a different way, if you go to a virtual environment, by definition, your viewpoint has to change from being me-centered to being client-centered. And I think over the course of time, it's far better for the growth of your firm, in my humble opinion.
I 100% agree. And I didn't understand that.
I didn't know it.
When I started my firm, absolutely 100% did not understand that. But I didn't know how to be a business owner. I was a lawyer. I wasn't a business owner when I started my firm. Yeah. I was just a lawyer.
Yeah. Well, and look, it creates its own challenges. Okay, it has its own issues. Not to say it's nirvana, you know, going to a virtual experience or a more client-oriented law firm. It presents its own challenges, but I think they're more easily overcome and managed than some of the other issues in the opposite, you know, kind of approach. You started your law practice to ditch the firm life and be your own boss, but your practice is running you. The good news, being an attorney entrepreneur doesn't have to be this hard. Jesse and Megan, the lawpreneurs behind Jurisdiction, are working to build a new generation of solo practitioners who love being lawyers. This year, Jurisdiction is introducing a new program, Next Level Law Practice. Next Level Law Practice is a rigorous training program that provides the tools and business fundamentals for estate planning attorneys to start and grow a profitable and streamlined legal business. Next Level Law Practice gives you access to videos, worksheets, templates, one-on-one coaching, and live group sessions that allow you to ask questions and learn on your own schedule. To learn more about the program, visit thrivejd.com. That's thrivejd.com. They're even offering an exclusive coupon code for the Law Entrepreneur listeners. Just enter the code TLE150, that's like the Law Entrepreneur 150, for a $150 discount off your course registration. And welcome to the show, Jurisdiction. Support for today's episode comes from Ruby Receptionists, dedicated to helping you grow your practice one happy caller at a time. From their offices in Portland, Oregon, Ruby's live remote receptionists create an exceptional experience for your callers by answering calls live with your custom greeting, delighting callers in English or Spanish, transferring calls, taking messages, collecting new client intake, and much more. Just like an in-house receptionist at a fraction of the cost. For 15 years, Ruby has been turning rings into relationships. For more information, call 844-895-7829 or visit callruby.com/lawentrepreneur. So along those lines, you know, what are some of the key aspects of your virtual practice? So I'm assuming that you still on occasion need to meet clients, very less so than before, but you still need to meet them at some point in time. Do you do that in a public setting? Do you do that in a virtual office setting? And what are some of the tools that you use to facilitate your virtual practice?
Sure. So I love using Zoom and Skype.
Yeah.
I do a lot of video calls with my clients. And in part because my clients aren't all local. So they're not even all within a distance where it's convenient for them or possible for them to come and have a face-to-face conversation with me.
Or remotely in the same time zone.
Right. Or in the same country.
Yeah.
So for me and, you know, my firm, Zoom and Skype are super important. I also do calls on WhatsApp.
Yep.
So those three pieces of technology are huge and used daily. Some clients I do meet in person before they have an interview with a government agency, and we'll do a mock interview in person. Some clients I do that same mock interview on video conference or over the phone. Because again, if I have a client that's sitting overseas and their interview is at the consulate, well, I'm not flying overseas.
No, that's the only thing you can do.
Yeah. So, you know, and again, some of my clients just don't have the time for the ones that are, you know, geographically close. So sometimes the first time I am, you know, able to shake my client's hand, not the first time I've seen them in person, but, you know, because I've seen their face on video conference, but the first time I've shaken their hand is when I meet them and we go into the interview. But we've built such a good rapport up until that point that it's really very seamless for them. And I have specifically asked my clients about that. And they said, no, I didn't feel like there was something missing. They really liked the video component of it because it allowed for them to see, you know, kind of the whites of my eyes and see facial expressions, but also allowed them to take a call from home at 5 o'clock at night.
Yeah.
You know,
what about, let's talk some of the nitty gritty details. How do you handle getting your retainer agreement signed?
All of that is electronic. That entire process is electronic. So
what platform do you use?
I use DocuSign.
Okay.
Super easy. There are controls within DocuSign. You can have people reminded for a certain number of days about the contract. You can void the contract after a certain number of days, but it's really easy and you can have more than one signatory on the contract.
And you can use it from your laptop or your mobile device.
Yep. Absolutely. So I can sit on the beach and send out an engagement agreement.
You know, the thing that I recently learned that I have to explore more about is the use of templates within something like DocuSign or HelloSign.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of just taking a PDF file and importing it every time, you need to have a retainer agreement signed. You have it built within the platform itself as a template.
Right. So you and I actually, before we started this conversation, had a conversation offline about engagement agreements. And that was actually one of the reasons I wanted to have that conversation with you, because I'm looking to streamline my engagement process with a little bit more template like that process. I mean, I'm happy with my current process, but I'm always looking for ways to be a little bit more efficient.
And then how about the all important getting paid?
I use LawPay. So I have links to my trust account as well as my operating account. So when I send out an invoice, I embed a link and it is easy peasy to get paid.
Is immigration law largely a flat fee process or hourly or a hybrid combination of both?
I think it is majority flat fee. There are certainly some things that are, I think, maybe a little bit better suited to more of a hybrid scenario. But I think by and large, most of my colleagues are doing flat fees.
Yeah. You know, one of the trends that I'm seeing more and more, and look, I'm not omniscient here. It's just going around and talking to a lot of folks around the country who have different types of practices in different areas. More and more are interacting with their client almost exclusively via messaging systems, using WhatsApp or other SMS type-based messaging systems, as opposed to email or snail mail, And I just find that kind of interesting. And I'm kind of supposing here talking with you that in the immigration law space, that might even be more prevalent. Is that something you've noticed, or?
So this is where I am slightly a dinosaur. I am not a fan of texting with clients. I will say yet, I'm quite sure at some point I will come around to it. I'm not saying this doesn't exist. I just have not found a way to efficiently catalog and keep record of text messages. Oftentimes I find that some clients want to start the conversation on email, finish it up in text, and that becomes hard for me personally.
Yeah.
I know criminal attorneys, my criminal attorney friends especially, text a lot with their clients. And for them it works. But they've all told me they haven't really figured out a good way to download those texts and keep them even electronically in their client files. So every so often I sort of, you know, go on this mission. I'm going to find the right system for me, and I just haven't found it yet. And also I think we talked about this a little bit earlier. I want boundaries. And I worked with an attorney, and he still does this, and it still completely irritates me, but I totally get why he does it. He doesn't have voicemail set up on his cell phone.
Yeah.
He will give clients his cell phone number, but he doesn't have voicemail set up. And I said to him one day, I said, that doesn't make any sense to me. Why do you do that? And he said, because I'm happy to have my clients call me on my cell phone, but I do not want 50,000 voicemail places that I have to check. And I said, okay, that makes sense. So yeah. I'm kind of in that camp a little bit when it comes to texting. And
well, let me make a suggestion for you.
Yes.
There's a platform called Podium. Podium, podium.com. Mm-hmm. And they sponsored the show. They're no longer a sponsor, but they were also one of the vendors at the Clio Cloud Conference in San Diego this past fall. And they have a tremendous platform for doing just that. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing is you get a unique phone number that's not your cell phone number. And you and or your team are all able to control the text messaging interface with the client from the same web-based platform. It also has a app that you can use on your phone as well. So I think they've largely addressed that issue. So you may want to take a look at that.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
I will definitely look at that.
And it's really interesting because I was concerned about the whole idea of establishing a relationship with a potential client and ultimately an actual client using text messaging alone. And so their platform has templates and actual text messaging sequences. So you can actually program a sequence of text messages that would then go to that individual on a time-based or conditional-based prompt. So I think they've largely addressed that problem. And I have no interest in the company. They're not a sponsor of the show, but I'm really impressed with that platform. So for people who have a need to, I'm seeing it more and more with my younger clients. They don't read their email. Literally, they don't read it. And when I meet them in person, they show me their phone, and the phone has a little red badge that says 4,000 unread emails. It just tilts me. I don't know what to do about that. And I say, yeah, if you need to get a hold of me, you got to text me.
Yeah. I mean, I want to move in that direction. I just need to find the right piece of tech that will take
me. We'll give podium.com. You know, a look, and anybody else who does that, let them know I sent you.
I will indeed.
Anyway, well, Kara, listen, I want to thank you for taking the time to be with us today. I've learned a heck of a lot, and I hope our audience has as well. If they want to reach out to you and follow up with anything we've talked about today, what's the best way to reach you?
They can call the office and they will get me. My number is 954 903 1337. They can also reach out to me on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. I am at USA Visa Guru, USA VISA GURU, or they can reach out to me on LinkedIn. And that's just my plain Jane government name, which is Carol Williams.
I love that US Visa US Visa Guru. That's really good.
I like it, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. All right. Well, Carol, let's stay in touch. And I appreciate you being a guest here today on The Law Entrepreneur.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Well, that will do it, fellow law entrepreneurs, for this episode of The Law Entrepreneur. I want to thank our sponsors this week. That would be Ruby Receptionists and Jurisdiction. Be sure to visit us on our website at www.thelawentrepreneur.com or check us out on our social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, you name it. Just search for The Law Entrepreneur. You'll find us. Make sure you consider joining our private Facebook group where we'll be having some new offerings starting the first of the year. So I want you to have a great week, and we'll see you next time. And thank you for listening to The Law Entrepreneur.